Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Selling guns is like selling vacuum cleaners. You make calls, pound the pavement. I supply to every army but the Salvation Army.
Gun of Rambo.
Part one, two, or three?
I've only seen part one.
Of all the weapons in the vast Soviet arsenal, nothing was more profitable than Avtomat Kalashnikova, model of 1947, more commonly known as the AK-47 or Kalashnikov. It's the world's most popular assault rifle, a weapon all fighters love. An elegantly simple 9-pound amalgamation of forged steel and plywood. It doesn't break, jam, or overheat. It will shoot whether it's covered in mud or filled with sand. It's so easy, even a child can use it, and they do. The Soviets put the gun on a coin. Mozambique put it on their flag. Since the end of the Cold War, the Kalashnikov has become the Russian people's greatest export. After that comes vodka, caviar, and suicidal novelists. One thing's for sure, no one was lining up to buy their cars.
Day to you. It is 16 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of July in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming by, making it part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. My name is Rick Emerson. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday, July 13th, 2010. If you would like to be part of today's program, here's how you do it. It is so easy that even an underdeveloped child can do it. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964 if you would like to engage with us telephonically. You can also do it via email. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor has a dawn@rickemerson.com address, but she didn't really use it. It's a thing that she did merely to placate or to humor me. It's not a thing that she actually checks, and if you send her something there, I would imagine she most likely won't respond to it. Am I right, Dawn?
I might.
All right.
I may check it.
There you go.
I'm planning to check it more often.
At some point in the future, it's a thing you're going to do, one of these days when you get around to it.
I check it right now, but, you know, I'm working.
You've been busy.
I've been busy.
Okay. And, thank you to, let's see, I'm looking here, thank you to Dorkface9, who sent me this charming text. Hey, dude, it's one, where are you at? You know, it's not easy what we do here, friend. Doing the best I can. I had to get my Nicolas Cage speech ready. There you go, that from Lord of War, which is one of the finest films in the Nicolas Cage filmography. That's a great movie. I never get
where
tired of it.
Where are you at, Rick Emerson?
Hey, dude, it's one, where are you at? Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm glad that you're enthusiastic about the program. It is, it's heartening to me that there's a sort of rapacious need on the part of the audience to hear the show as soon as 1 o'clock rolls around. But I, look, I'm only one man. I'm only one man! Shackles. In any event, it's 503-505-6964. That is the number at which around 1:45 today, Mr. John Rogers, creator of Showrunner 4, executive writer on, and there was a fourth thing there. I tried to do four, and then I failed because I can't come up with a fourth euphemism for being the guy who runs the entire joint. But he is the guy behind the television show Leverage. He was on Outlook Portland, I don't know, maybe eight weeks ago, something like that, and really just one of the best guests we've ever had. Just a fantastic guest in every way. So we wanted to get him on the radio program here, but of course he's busy. He's flying back and forth, hither and yon, higgledy-piggledy, rat-a-tat-tat, being the maven of his own sort of media empire. So John Rogers from Leverage going to be here 1:45. Coming up later on today as well, we have today's top five Jim Steinman compositions that are not Meatloaf songs. So he's sort of the guy behind the Bat Outta Hell record and then subsequent Meatloaf recordings. But we are going to we're going to avoid those because it's, you know, it's like when we did that top five that was about top five car songs and we had to make like a no Beach Boys rule because otherwise the whole thing is just Brian Wilson songs. So today we'll have the top five Jim Steinman compositions that are not Meatloaf songs. Also got a double Geek Watch coming up today. Clown Watch. Coming today, and a snuff watch as well. So we have that, and just the whole pile of other things. I got this barista thing that like nine different people have sent to me. So I keep meaning to get to that, and I'm just behind with it. Let's see. I've got somebody asking. What's this say? This email says, Rick. What this is like with a guy who says it's 1 o'clock. Where are you at? This is a guy. Says, yo, Rick, what do you think of the new Kanye? Here's my thing about the new Kanye West. Have you heard the new Kanye West song, Don? I asked.
I have not.
Knowing the answer? No, of course you haven't. Here's the thing that's notable to me about the new Kanye West song. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because why? Because it's not really like I'm going to make or break that guy's career at this point. To me, like I long ago got over the whole idea that there's a whole thing about, you know, whether sampling is an art form or whether it's, you know, whether it's stealing or whether it's theft or whether it's a musical. To me, I came to the conclusion many years ago. I spent a while sort of in the rock purist camp that sampling was somehow hackery. But I've come around to the belief that not only is it really is that collage is sort of the great art form of the late 20th century and early 21st century in America. So I can see it as part of that. But that is neither here nor there. The great thing about the new Kanye West song is that he's sampling a song by King Crimson, which, like, see, that's it right there. That look on your face is why I said that. I mean, you want to talk about picking the least likely guy out of a lineup.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if I'm going to sample, where's the wanky prog rock band that nobody really listens to? Oh, you, King Crimson. Fantastic. I'm going to sample
next
one of your...
television.
It's just the weirdest thing. I mean, yeah, it would be like him sampling a Sonic Youth song or something. It makes no sense. So anyway, the new Kanye West single, maybe, I don't see, now I feel like I have to play. We'll dig it and play later. It's not very good. It's an okay song. It just it goes on way too long. It's like 6.5 minutes long. Kanye has obviously reached that J.K. Rowling, Stanley Kubrick point in his career where nobody is allowed to edit him, even when something is just going on in a sort of turgid, tepid, uninteresting fashion, as the new single does. But it samples 21st Century Schizoid Man, which is just like it just bends your brain. Anyway, so we'll get to that later on. It is 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Speaking of leverage, so I would be remiss if I did not just mention this right out of the gate, because I put out a Twitter thing about this last night. So when was my audition? It was what the hell day
yesterday
is today?
Yesterday morning.
All right, so it was yesterday morning. So today is Tuesday. So yesterday, Monday morning, I had a busy day because I got up, went to Beaverton, filmed Outlook Portland, immediately left Outlook Portland, sped, breaking every posted speed regulation and traffic law known to man, sped to Northwest Portland to audition for this part on an upcoming episode of Leverage, auditioning for the highly coveted role of morgue attendant, and nailed it, baby. See, and you thought I was just, I was pulling your lariat when I came in here and I told you
I
needed
you.
Rick Emerson drove that baby home. I put it in the garage. I parked it. And
daggered it.
That's exactly what I did for screaming in pain. And I was, you know, and I said, because I didn't have to, you know, have an accent of any kind. I didn't have to speak like I was from the South or from anywhere but from my own dirt heel hometown. I thought I did a pretty great job. I'm at home last night. It's like 7 o'clock, 7:30, and I'm thinking, well, Rick, you know, another shoot, another miss. Guess we'll just put it on the wall of rejections. More reasons why you're lame. And then at 7:47 last night, and yes, I am this neurotic that I made a note of when the email came in from my agent. My agent, who just continues to send me on audition for things that I don't ever get. So, God bless him. I mean, you know, whatever that guy needs. You know, if at some point he just calls me from the side of the road. Like, if my agent were to call me and just say, look, I need you to come meet me in a hotel room and bring all the bleach and rubber gloves that you have and a chainsaw and don't ask me anything, I would do it. Because he keeps sending me in auditions and I keep failing. And he's getting 10% of zero, baby.
Yeah, he's kind of operating at a deficit at
yes,
this point, isn't
I'm
he?
I'm sort of a farm team player right now, I think. That's the deal. But he sees potential in me. So last night he sends me this thing. He's like, "You got to call back, baby." And I'm, you know, said just like an agent. You know, like I sort of see him, you know, sort of see him standing next to Jeremy Piven and holding a cigar. You know, it's Spago. But he says, "Call back, baby, leverage." And the thing is, I had been told the callback time, and a callback is like a second audition. It's like if you audition for the job, you know, you're going for a job interview, and then they have you come back and do it again. The second time is the callback. And the first, well, yeah, have you ever auditioned for things like a movie or a TV show or like a professional audition?
Yeah, I have gone on professional auditions.
And so you know the thing is, the first time, it's like a cattle call, they need to say, where basically, you know, it's like anybody with a pulse. I mean, I'm not trying to knock it, but I'm just saying, like, in other words, they'll throw the doors open and let a lot of people in to try to audition.
Right.
The callback is where they narrow it down to 10 or 12 people. And then sometimes they can do as many as, this is the really terrifying thing. When you go into audition for leverage, and I'm assuming for most things, because it's on the form, you circle what audition it is. In other words, is this your first time trying out for this part? Is it your second time reading for the role? Is it, and it goes all the way up to 5. I mean, imagine how nerve-wracking that must be. You got to go read for the role 5 times.
I can't imagine they're going to have a lot of callbacks, though, for morgue attendants.
No,
I'm just saying.
Saying anybody could do it? Huh?
I'm thinking, though, if it was a larger role.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Then you might, you know, but.
But I'm saying that's why I'm so glad that I'm not relying on acting to make a living. In other words, I'm not trying to make my bones as an actor. That's not, by trade, that is not what I do. And I've done some acting, but it's not my bailiwick. And I'm glad because imagine having to do 5 auditions for a role. How nerve-wracking that would be. I mean, you would just, no wonder they're all drunks. I mean, it's just, you know.
That's one of the reasons why I ultimately didn't pursue acting. It was what I really wanted to do when I was young. When I was like in high school, I was a high school drama geek. Got into my 20s and I started going on auditions and it was horrible. It was just soul killing.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it enough because you get rejected like 500 times for every single tiny little thing you actually get.
And you have to just believe in yourself, I think, to an almost, and again, you know, I got many friends that are actors, and I don't mean that in a whole, you know, I don't want them marrying into my family, though, kind of way. I mean, I have a lot, I mean, you and I both know a lot of people who act.
Yeah.
And I don't mean act like, you know, like some dick you meet who's had a script he's working on somewhere at home that will never be, you know, somebody, no, I'm working on a novel, you know. But I mean, we, you know, you and I are very fortunate that we know a lot of very talented people who are creative types. And you have to have an almost just insane, I mean, clinically insane belief in your own greatness to go on auditions over and over and, you know, to basically make an appointment for somebody to go in and kick you in the balls and say, no, you know, and then send you home.
Well, and in some cases, they will actually tell actors why they're rejecting them too. They'll just
that's got to be fun.
Or tell their agent, and the agent will pass it on. It's like, yeah, you were too short. You weren't Japanese enough.
See, you now, is would you want to know if you went in an audition for a role? Would you want to know why they rejected you? Let me ask you this. Let me just put it this
if
way.
If it was something I couldn't do anything about.
No, hold on.
Sure.
Let's say I have an envelope. You've auditioned for a role, not huge. But not, you know, one line. It's a decent one-time role in a show. You know, you're best friend of the murdered guy.
Okay.
And then you go on audition, and the agent says, no, you didn't get the part. And in this envelope, they've given me the reason why. Do you want to know?
No.
Okay, see, me either.
No.
You know, it's like, I didn't get it. I don't care. Because if they say, like, you're hideous, you know, your head is huge, you scare children, we can't even bear to look at you. Then I'd just as soon not know that.
You look weirdly lopsided on camera.
That's, you know,
that's
my thing. So I would prefer not to know. So I got the callback. He's like, hey, callback, fantastic. And the callback had originally been, they tell you at the outset, they're like, if there is a callback, it will be at this time. And if you are cast in the role, the shoot days will be, you know, Saturday through Tuesday from like 5 to 9 p.m. or whatever. So you can tell them right now, like, if you're going to be available or if you're going to be gone. And I said, 3 o'clock? No problem. I can do that. So then I get the callback email last night. Hey, by the way, and also Dean Devlin's got to fly back to L.A., so the callback's been moved up to 1:30. And I said, hooray! Crap. Because then I realized, not only am I doing the show at 1:30, or 1:45, which is actually when they want me. I said, I'm actually interviewing John Rogers, the creator of Leverage, at 1:45. So that's irony. Or maybe not. I don't even know what irony is anymore. I forget. So I had to email back. I'm like, dear agent, I know that you are investing time in me and you've made nothing because I suck. Also, that you got me this audition and I got a callback. I won't be going. Said, I'll be interviewing John Rogers on my radio program, and thanks so much. I then put a little Twitter thing up about it, and, you know, sort of, I'm not complaining. It does feel in some ways like a very me thing to happen. You know, like, hey, I have this great show. Hey, I have this great audition. Hey, they're at the same time. You can only do one. The good news, though, is I do believe that the agency actually wrangled a different audition time for me. So I think I am still going on the call back this afternoon. See, but now the pressure's really on, because now if I choke, then it's like they went out of their way to wrangle a different time for me, and then I just repaid them with failure.
I wonder if the fact that you're actually interviewing John Rogers at that time held any sway in getting your audition time.
You know,
changed.
Here's the thing. As dumb as it makes me sound, I hadn't actually considered that until just now when you said those words. By God, I wonder if it did. Hey, you know what? I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. You know, it's like if somebody says, you know, that girl's only dating you because you got money. F do I care. I have no, you know, it matters not to me. If somebody says, you know, it's like I when I was a younger DJ, and people, you know, and the kids, people used to, DJs used to be guys who were on the radio, and they were famous to some degree because that was the only place you could hear new music played.
Yes.
And so, you know, there was a fair amount of sort of low-level rodeo clown style fame that went with that. And occasionally, you know, you would meet a young lady because she was listening to the radio and you were on the radio and hey. And people would say, well, you know, she's only sleeping with you because you're a DJ. And you're like, ah. And that matters to me. How does that change the end product? Let me see. Not at all. So that's fine. If I can even pose for a moment as like a power broker, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be that thing, Don Taylor. So that's what I'm doing today. We get off the air. I got to go find a headshot because I didn't think I was, because when I left the house today, because this whole thing where you got to have the 8-bite, I sound like such a dick. I sound like such a douche actor. It's amazing how just adding a few keywords to your vocabulary just make you sound like some acting dork. You know, now I got to get my headshot because I left them at home because I didn't think I was going to be able to make the call back. So I got to get that, and that's going to be my afternoon. So once we do this,
it could be worse. You could carry one of those little man purse portfolios around with you, and always have headshots with you.
And a treatment that I'm working on, you know, and also the name of a writing group that I'm part of. Would you like to come by on Wednesday? There's a lot of great ideas happening there. Jesus. All right. What did you do last night, Don Taylor? Well, you had to leave right after the show because you had some sort of medical. You had to go be prodded somewhere sensitive.
It had been like a year and a half since I'd had a medical test, medical checkup. And I had to go just so I could make sure I could keep, you know, getting my prescriptions for crazy pills and things like that.
Excellent. So. I'm a big fan of you getting prescriptions for crazy pills and staying on them.
And the good news is I'm healthy as a horse. Other than needing a new knee, everything about, you know, blood pressure's fine, everything's fine, everything's good. Except every year I go see my doctor, and every year she tells me to go get a mammogram, and every year I come up with some excuse not to do it because I just don't want to, because I had one a very long time ago, and it's unpleasant, and I just don't want to.
Yeah, but you know what else is unpleasant? Is dying, or not even that, really, having parts of your body lopped off.
So
ask your husband how he feels about that.
She gave me, she basically pointed out that I now live like 3 blocks from a legacy medical center where I could get the blood work that she wants done and the mammogram and this one-shot stop kind of a thing. And I'm like, okay, so
fine.
I'm gonna have to go have that done. She also told me if I felt like it, I said, do you want to get a colonoscopy?
As like a bonus? Was she trying to upsell you?
Well, I said,
No, don't answer yet. You also get.
Yeah, I don't know. No.
Was that like an added value thing? Like you weren't, like you were wavering?
I think it's Dr. Humor. It's like, I'm going to make you do this one thing you don't really want to do. It's like, while you're at it, would you all, you know? And apparently, you don't really have to start thinking about colonoscopies until you're in your early 50s. And then really they're important if you're
become sort of a mandatory kind
well,
of a
if you have
a family
of your parents,
history, as they say.
Yeah, if either of your parents had colon cancer, then you should look at it. But my doctor herself, she's 62, and she just had her first one for the first time. And I asked her, if it was horrible, if it was unpleasant, and she said,
well, they're jamming a thing into an area of your body where typically, I mean, you have to, you know, unless you've made a date for that sort of thing, you don't want stuff jammed in there. I would think.
I would think so too. But she said the procedure itself really wasn't unpleasant at all.
Is it the thing with the dread? It's the building up to it that is the that's bad.
Well, she said that it was the 2 days leading up to it where you have to take the special drinks to clean yourself out.
Oh, you have to
out.
Like a barium enema or something.
Yeah, well, you drink stuff and then you spend 2 days just running to the bathroom.
Excreting.
Constantly. And she didn't take any time off and she was trying to see patients at the same time. And she said it was quite unpleasant.
No, I had a friend of mine who did that and he had a lower GI or an upper GI, a something GI. But they gave him a barium. He was drinking barium and I asked what that was like. And he said it was like drinking a milkshake made of metal. He said it's really what it is, and I guess barium actually is metal, so that makes sense. He said it was a milkshake made of melted metal, and that was, you know, and he had to do that for however many days, because you gotta clean everything out. You gotta just get it all taken care of.
Well, the sad thing about doing this now is that it's starting to infect my brain because I'm sitting there talking to her, and I said, well, you know, I don't want to get the mammogram, but it'll be something I can talk about on the radio.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. All right. And on that note, ladies and gentle folks, will you please give her your attention? She is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Some Oregon lawmakers are working on a plan to outlaw disposable plastic bags in the state in 2012. The effort is led by Senator Mark Haas of Beaverton and Senator Jason Atkinson of Central Point. The two introduced a plastic bag ban in February's special session. Haas says he's been working with grocers and environmentalists and others since then to encourage the use of reusable canvas bags. Opponents of the ban say people can prevent plastic bags from becoming litter or going into landfills by simply recycling them.
Well, how about opponents of the ban say, you know, maybe you could just not treat us like retarded children for once. Maybe treat us like adults who are able to make our own decisions about what we purchase and what we take those purchases home. And not to mention the fact, and I mean, I spent a good hour talking to, taking calls about this maybe a year and a half ago. We were trying to figure out. Because I never know, and I think I'm not alone here. It's a double negative, but when I go to the store and the woman says, and it's always like some hot chick, that's the only time it's ever a hot chick at Safeway is when I'm confused with the paper or plastic thing, because I'll be getting my purchases and she says, okay, that's great. Is that going to be paper or plastic today? And then I think about it and I realize that I don't actually know what I'm supposed to say. Hmm. I don't know which one of those is the invite. Okay, so you're standing in line. I'm the checker, you're buying your frozen banana guacamole, and I say, that's great. That'll be $4.50. You give me a $5. I give you 50 cents, and I say, okay, paper or plastic, miss? And then you say what?
Well, is this happening in the summer or the winter?
Are you just stalling for time? What difference does that make?
No, you're asking me how I would make this decision. And I will tell you, first of all,
it's right now. It's
today. It's my understanding that, environmentally speaking, it's actually more damaging to the environment to manufacture paper bags than plastic.
Well, and also you're cutting down trees. That
right.
would be my other thing.
And then there's more electricity and more toxins and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in the production of the paper bag.
See, and that's what I would say as well. It seems like paper is a bad choice.
Now, as a consumer, I base my choices on, in the wintertime when it's very, very cold and I'm using my fireplace a lot,
yes.
I will get more paper bags because I use them rolled up as sort of kindling under the firewood to light the fire.
Ah, so you have a second use then. There's
the rest
a,
of the year, I collect the grocery bags and stick them in a box by the front door to use them as poop bags when I take my dog out.
Is that the clinical term for them as poop bags?
Yes, we call them poop bags.
And here's the interesting thing about that. And by interesting, I mean interesting only to other dog enthusiasts who will go on and on about their animals at the drop of a hat, or even without a hat being dropped, is that that's what I do with my plastic bags from Safeway. And I always here, and the thing
is, so it's like the plastic bags become the poop bags. In the wintertime, I get more paper bags. They go in the fireplace.
And the other thing that I've noticed, by the way, is that it does, now that I'm kind of putting this together in my head, it does seem like it is only female checkers at Safeway that ask me. Because I get the feeling that, and I'm stereotyping here, but I know that I get the feeling it's a thing that women are more conscious of, or they care about more, or that guys either can't be bothered to think about the environment, or they just sort of realize the futility of it. Again, I always sound like I'm being cynical here, but it's like, but your choice of using paper or plastic is going to save or harm nothing. Like the net impact, if you were to sort of extrapolate out all of the good things and all of the damage being done to the earth, everything in the plus column, everything in the negative column. Your decision to use paper or plastic is going to make, like, dick difference.
On the other hand, though, on a statewide basis, though, I mean, plastic bags do take a really long time to break down in landfills. And so if you know, you actually outlaw them for the entire state and people get into the habit of using reusable bags, you're going to have an awful lot less plastic that's going into the environment.
Okay, I get this when they say that, okay, plastic bags take forever to break down. We will leave aside the issue for the moment that plastic bags are themselves natural. They're made. It's not like they came from outer space. They're made from the earth. I mean, that's the other thing that people will just sort of gloss over. I mean, you cannot create or destroy matter. Plastic bags are made from the earth. They are made from things found naturally on planet Earth.
It's a very liberal use of the word natural, though, because basically by that logic, anything that exists or can be created is natural.
Yeah, it is, which is why we need to at least all look, as I think George Carlin once said, you can agree or disagree with a certain political viewpoint or outlook, but can we at least all agree that we're going to use the same language and that the words are all going to mean the same thing to everybody? So when people say that they're unnatural, that just clouds the argument because that makes it seem like it's some sort of nefarious substance that came from like Deimos as it was, you know, circling Mars or something. It really is. I mean, you can say that it's harmful, or you can say that it takes too long to degrade, or you can say that it's something from the earth that is not good for human beings for some reason or other. But to say that it's unnatural, that is just it's an artificially, I believe that is a misleadingly broad and inaccurate term.
See, and I don't think so. I think they are unnatural, but I think
that's
you
like
know,
saying glass is unnatural. I mean, well, glass
no,
is made
glass,
out of sand.
Glass is created in nature, though.
Well, so it,
glass actually exists in nature.
So do plastic bags. You're part of nature. Humans are part of nature. It is a closed system.
So there's some grove of paper of plastic bag trees where when we manufacture things, when we create things from chemicals and from whatever. I mean, honestly, paper bags are unnatural too. They don't just exist already in nature.
That's like saying a bird's nest is unnatural because it takes something, because somebody has to build it. Because it has to be constructed, the bird's nest is not part of nature. It's been manufactured by somebody. Well, everything's been manufactured. Beavers manufacture dams. It doesn't mean they're bad. So you said we're totally getting off the point here.
Okay.
I'm just the only point I was going to make is leaving aside the issue of plastic bags and whether they are, quote, unnatural. Like so, they go. People say, "Well, they go into landfills and they take forever to degrade." And my response, and I'm not trying to be obtuse here. I'm really not. As the audience will tell you, I just don't understand a lot of things. So they take forever to degrade. Like, so what? The plastic bag is here. You know, this week it's also going to be here in a year. Guess what? I don't know why I'm supposed to care about that.
Well, they also get into the waterways. They damage sea life, animals, fish.
So if I've got a landfill behind my house and I'm putting plastic bags in there,
well,
it's damaging fish.
Plastic bags go a lot of other places besides just the landfill. They end up in the ocean. They end up in the rivers. They end up, you know, in your backyard. They end up stuck in trees. You see them when you're driving down.
Well,
the
yeah,
road,
but see,
trees.
But,
they end up all over the place.
But now you're not talking about plastic bags being a problem. You're talking about littering being a problem. You're talking about people. In other words. You know,
but if we had no plastic bags, those particular plastic bags would not be littering.
Well, you know, cars end up on top of Girl Scouts, you know, sometimes. A guy's, you know, driving the wrong way. You know, if a guy has one too many when he leaves the bar, car could end up in your living room, you know. It's not the car's fault. Car shouldn't be in your living room. Don't put it there, you know.
What?
I'm saying you're talking about a misuse of the item, not the item itself. I'm sorry. Let me just, it seems like I should probably answer this telephone. Hold on. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. This is the Rick Emerson radio program. Who may I say is calling?
This is John Rogers.
John Rogers, it's Rick Emerson. How are you, sir?
Hi. How are you doing, sir?
I was doing this thing where I was answering the phone just now, A, without a screener, and B, while my co-host Don and I were having an alternately heated slash utterly absurd argument slash discussion about paper bags. Let me ask you this. John Rogers, who is the creator, showrunner for, head writer of Leverage, which films in Our Fair City, and he's also written or co-written screenplays, including Transformers and The Core. He contributed to the fourth edition's Dungeons & Dragons Manual of the Planes. So I'm getting all of this correct.
That's correct.
As part of all this, and I know that we're just plunging headlong into something completely different, like 5 seconds into this call, you divide your time right now between Portland, Oregon, and Los Angeles, which is a city that is alternately very atavistic and sort of very bleeding heart at the same time. So you are the perfect person to ask this question of. If you are going to the supermarket and you're there and you're buying your bananas and your Coke Zero and whatever, and the woman rings it up and she says
duct tape, garbage bags, hacksaw blades, the sort of things you buy when you go shopping.
Your quick lime and the woman says, "Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Will that be paper or plastic today?" In your opinion, not only what is the right choice, but what is the answer you are? What do you feel like you're supposed to say in response to paper or plastic?
Well, the right choice is, of course, I brought my own bag. Thank you very much.
Oh, see, and the pupil becomes the teacher. Well done.
The thing is, it's I'm not sure that the forces of political correctness are all that oppressive in our lives. I mean, there's no great audience watching us. Just get a paper or plastic bag, whatever makes you happy, you know. Plastic bags you can reuse for dog poop and paper bags recycle. There's no sin there.
Yeah, you're like a sort of brusque Zen koan that's just come over the phone to me. All right, well, I apologize for plunging you headlong into a discussion in which you hadn't really no stake.
Not at all. I believe last time we did a long thing about the sexuality of the Addams Family, so really.
That is true. No, and this is – okay, so let me just back up a second. And as they used to say in the Phantom comic strip, for those who came in late – so for Outlook Portland, which is the show that I do on the CW, Mr. John Rogers here was gracious enough to be our guest a few weeks back, maybe 6-8 weeks. And it was one of the best shows. And I'm not just saying that to wax your car, as Paul Thomas Anderson would say. It was really an exceptional show. But and Don, you've been on Outlook Portland. You know that when we get ready to film, the first thing we do is we do a test question, and that's just to make sure that everybody's microphones are working, there's no static, that everybody can be heard, right, that somebody hasn't put the mic on the inside of their shirt by accident, you know, whatever. And my test questions are usually an either-or. So I will say pancakes or waffles, or Madonna or Cyndi Lauper. This time I said Addams Family or Munsters. And John busts out like this. I swear to God, it was like this 12-minute soliloquy. It was like I could hear this sort of Aaron Copland music swelling up in the background. It was unbelievable as you talked about the Addams Family being – well, I don't put words in your mouth. It was a metaphor for something or other. Do you even remember?
Well, I vaguely remember because I was pretty drunk when we did that show. But it was the fact that if you read Harlan Ellison's book, The Glass Teat, about how television, particularly in the late 60s, early 70s, was designed to basically reinforce social order, and a lot of stuff that was disruptive was not allowed on television. And a friend of mine, Rick Jenkins, who runs the Comedy Studio out in Boston, once said, "You need to know everything. You can find out everything you need to know about America by knowing that for 1 week in 1969, the highest rated television show was The Brady Bunch, and the highest selling album was Jimi Hendrix." And that dichotomy always exists in American culture. And the Addams Family versus the Munsters is a sitcom. The Addams Family is a bunch of freaks. And there's something about the Addams Family where it was genuinely about people who don't belong and subversion, while the Munsters was kind of a pale echo of that. So, of course, the Addams Family is real art as opposed to the Munsters as kind of a tool of the patriarchy.
Well done. So he does that right there. He just busts out this great speech about the Addams Family versus the Munsters. And it was almost like one of those jokes at the beginning of Welcome Back, Kotter, almost. It was one of those jokes that Gabe Kaplan would tell, where I then said, all right, that was great. Colin, did we get that test question? Because I'm going to put that on the internet as soon as we're done. And Colin, looks up from his sandwich and just goes, what? And that was it. And it was lost. It just dissipated into the ether forevermore. So I'm glad that you were able to recreate it with,
I don't think the world is poorer by missing 12 minutes of me talking about 1960s television, but I appreciate the compliment.
Well, I have to say that the Carolyn Jones factor alone really, that puts Addams Family over the top. But I mean, what are you, Dawn? I can
Before Rick dives in with an actual question, one of the listeners just wrote something, and I don't understand it, but I'll share. She writes, "Some people have crushes on actors. I am smitten with John Rogers, even when he's dressed like Sailor Moon."
Now, I was never actually dressed like Sailor Moon. That is a misunderstanding. There was a moment in an episode I directed Leverage for the first time this year, where you find out that Parker, the thief character, Parker, has a series of fake addresses. and everyone looking for has gone to a different fake address. And the boys went to an anime shop where we got one of our production assistants, Kai, who's a very large man with a very thick beard, crammed into a Sailor Moon suit.
Awesome.
As the proprietor of the store. But I look a lot like Kai. I have the same sort of reddish beard. I'm kind of, you know, I'm a little bit on the heavy side. So a lot of people actually thought that was me doing a Sailor Moon cameo. But even I am not that brave. I've been in a dress once before in my life, and it was really a private thing. So, you know, I don't do that on television.
You know, that right now...
He, however, was totally fearless. He even wore the thigh-high white boots. That was... And what was even more terrifying, we found a Sailor Moon costume that fit a 240-pound man. That was what was really terrifying. It was just out there. We'd have to make it.
I have to tell you right now, there is probably some new form of slash lit being created on the internet. It is all about Roger's, you know, Sailor Moon lust is sort of confluence.
Oh, there's RP fic. There's Real Person fic, where fans write fiction about the creators and the writers on the shows and that sort of thing. It's floating around up there.
Really?
Yeah, it's part of my job as both an internet maven and being a friend of Warren Ellis to know horrible, horrible things.
Awesome. Now that we've we're already off the beaten path into the into the thorny undergrowth of geekdom, the other moment, and I don't want to be some guy sitting around, you know, talking like Larry King, going, "One night I was at Elaine's with Bogey, and he said the greatest thing." But I do have to say that after we shot Outlook Portland, we were standing around the set, and we were getting ready to do a still photograph, and we were talking, and it was myself and the aforementioned Mr. John Rogers is with us today, and Cheryl and somebody else, and you talked about being at, because I think I made a reference to what a great sort of, I felt like I was in a geek nexus, like the universe was going to reduce to some sort of nerd-like singularity, but you talked about having a moment on the set of Leverage that involved you and Jonathan Frakes and I think Mitnick and somebody else, but when you looked around, you realized...
Oh, you know, it was, we were, Kevin Mitnick, one of the world's most famous hackers, and Paul Robbins is our thief consultant. He's our crime consultant on the show. He runs a crew of hackers and thieves who actually consult for the police, like a little like a Leverage consulting group. And he was in town. We were shooting the Two Life Crew. We were shooting the episode where the team goes up against another team. And Mitnick consults for Apollo. And Will Wheaton played one of the bad guys on the show. And so we were in the bar, the bar at the lovely Deluxe Hotel, and I happen to have the digital dailies up because we shoot on the Red and we strip our footage straight from the Red camera into a hard drive that's dumped down under servers in LA and then put on the internet for us to review. And, you know, so I opened my MacBook Air that I happen to have at the time, and, you know, now it would be the tablet, and I flip it open and I'm showing Will and the guys the dailies, and I realize I'm in a bar 3,000 miles away from where these files are watching digital dailies that there's no film involved whatsoever, shot on digital cameras with Will Wheaton and Kevin Mitnick. This is the nerd singularity. This, only if we were actually playing Dungeons and Dragons at the time could this possibly have gotten geekier.
Which is
and listening to Jonathan Colton.
And listening to Jonathan Colton. Oh, if only. Well, now, I mean, that's what really ticked me off. I was supposed to be around for Woodstock, and I missed it. So, you know, I was really, you know, and they're not doing L.A. anymore, so I got to go hunt them down in another city.
It's funny, actually, as Woodstock approached and as it neared, Wheaton became this, it was like there was a Will Wheaton bounty or something. I mean, it was, it really was like he was D.B. Cooper or a Yeti or some such creature, because everybody I knew, it was like I couldn't go 10 minutes without starting a conversation with somebody, and we get into it, and they'd say, "Oh, hold on a second. I got to send my hourly Twitter to Will Wheaton. I'm trying to get him to stop by my, you know," and then insert comic book store, television show, radio show. Everybody was trying to like lasso Wheaton because I guess he was in town for this.
You know, he's a great example of new media. I mean, this is a guy who came off a television show, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and he got on the internet early. I mean, he was really one of the first guys on in building his audience and writing his own books and self-publishing. And, you know, we got an appreciable ratings bump when he was on the show. They're like, he has enough fans who watch him that they change the way the numbers work on television. And yet he's not, but nobody, I don't think, would consider him a giant mainstream star. But he is a guy who has, through sheer force of will and good personality, and he's also one of the nicest guys in the world, you know, and talent, has built an audience for him to do his work. I mean, and that's what's kind of... exciting about working in media right now. You know, a lot of the old stuff is going away. A lot of the money's going away. That's scary. But, you know, the cool stuff, the cool thing is new stuff happens.
You know, and the thing is, when you look at Wheaton, too, it's interesting when you look at old media to new media, and then you look at William Shatner and Will Wheaton, because they are almost analogs of one another in the sense that Shatner took what could have been Shatner took something that was a little, you know, a little corny, a little cheesy, and was starting to be viewed as sort of an outdated thing. And he turned into the skid, as it were, and said that, you know, this will be my persona then. I'm the corny guy from this sort of hokey television series, whatever. And Wheaton has not done exactly that, but he's done something similar to that, but with a more nuanced, respectful tone to it, where he has no illusions about himself, but he also just doesn't out and out turn it into a clown fest the way that Shatner does.
No, to a great degree, he's transcended that identity. And you know, Shatner did a lot of interesting things. I don't know if you've ever heard his album, the thing that Ben Folds produced. It's a great album. It is genuinely great spoken word album.
I actually heard that was the one that had the cover of Common People, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And no, it's a nice piece of work. Other showrunners on television, when they see how much I answer questions on the web and how much I Twitter, and they go, in their most charitable moods, they go, "Are you out of your mind?" But you know what? These are the people who go make fan videos and go advertise their show for free and spend an hour of their life watching the show. They have some questions. They deserve a little feedback.
We're talking to John Rogers. He's the creator of and overlord for the television program Leverage, which films in our fair city. This is a good time, actually, to ask. There has been an evolution of the way that television writers and media creators interact with people on the web. And you can go back to the guys who run The Simpsons, Bill Oakley and those guys, were some of the first ones to really be looking at what Simpsons fans said online, and maybe not hewing exactly to their whims, but taking into account. And then you got Aaron Sorkin, on the other hand, who was sort of famous for getting into just these online flame wars every time somebody criticized something about a West Wing episode or whatever. Do you guys does that response online shape in any way the way that the show unfolds, or stuff that you guys do in specifics?
Well, no, because you have to – yes and no. It's tricky. You have to take it into account where, you're seeing – even if you see 1,000 responses to something, we have 4.1 million viewers. So it's still going to be an enormously small sample, and it's going to be a very vocal sample. It's going to be a sample that has certain tendencies and attitudes because they're online. There was a great thing a little while ago where somebody said, a lot of people said, the aliases on the show were Peel and Steed. Everyone would have recognized that. And I had to break it to them. It's like that show went off in 1967. The only reason you recognize those names are because you are people who like television and you're on the internet. Nobody else would recognize them. And so, there's stuff like, for example, we always found the briefing scenes in the show where the team sort of sat down as a group and went through the bad guy of the week and what their plan was. We just found them really tedious. They're really hard to shoot. They're hard to write. They're hard to make interesting. And we were really trying to dodge them. And we found that the audience just loved them. The audience has adored seeing the family, quote unquote, together. And so that did definitely make us go, all right, even if this is a little grindy for us, it's nice to see that, this is an important part of the show. But as far as specific plot lines or relationships or anything like that, you can't cede that sort of creative control to anybody, much like I wouldn't expect any creator I'm a fan of to cede their creative control to me.
In terms of obsessive fan bases, and we mentioned this at the top of the interview here, that you, I think in 2008, you'd done some work on one of the Dungeons & Dragons guides. And that is, to say that that is an audience that has a vested interest in and a really intense loyalty to the product is an understatement of Gaussian proportions. When they approach you with something like that, is that where you kind of look at it for a long second and you say, if I do this poorly, I will never be able to leave my house again without some sort of a cloak of vanishing?
Well, it's the thing is you can't. Here's the thing. If I were doing something I wasn't familiar with, I might worry. But, I hung out on the EN boards and stuff. I know the D&D guys pretty well. I play. And so they're actually, surprisingly, they're a group that's used to things changing on a fairly regular basis. They just stay fans of old editions if they don't like the new edition. There is no constant world for that media space. The most rabid fan base was Transformers. That was what was surprising me. Because, they had not done anything in media for 20 or 30 years since the last Transformers movie, really. And so the fan base had ossified into kind of that canon. And so, you know, I got emails like, if Optimus Prime is the wrong type of truck, I will murder your family. I mean, it was just that wow. sort of, is he a Peterbilt? Is he a short nose, a long nose? What is he? You know, I think the people who are hardcore are not the ones you expect, because to a great degree, some of those fan bases are in a very vibrant online community, and they're used to a lot more sort of argument and variance. And I also find, if you go in, you treat them with respect, you say, I'm going to do my best, you might not like it, you might like it. If you dig it, great. You get by okay.
When you're doing something like Transformers, that is, on the one hand, you know, it's an established property, and maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe a property that you yourself, you know, had an emotional stake in, because, you know, it was something from your past or something that you really just wanted to see done right. But on the other hand, you know that because it is an established property, it is something that you, you know, when all is said and done, you have to turn it over to the studio, and they're going to do what they're going to do. Is it difficult to let go of that once you've turned in your draft and it's in their hands?
You know, if you were, you couldn't do the job. You know, there are scripts that, it's more like there are scripts I've written that haven't gotten made, that they keep sucking me back to go to do one more draft to try to get made because I love the script or I love the project. But, you know, on a movie like that, I knew I wasn't going to be the last guy on. I mean, you work in the industry long enough, you know how it works. I tend to now only take projects I know that I can endure the experience of.
Well, and that's actually, so Don and I listed off yesterday, so you've done, the Dungeons & Dragons Guide, Leverage, obviously, you've written screenplays, continue to write screenplays, you've done comics work, you've done stand-up comedy. Of all of those things, there was this famous Orson Welles quote where he talked about working on movies as being the biggest electric train set a boy could ever have. So of all the things that you've done and are doing right now, which of those comes closest to kind of embodying that feeling for you?
It's Leverage. It's running a television show. You know, it's the great thing about writing television is they make it. You know, I've worked on 20 movies, and they made 3 of them, and they were giant, and I wasn't anywhere near them, you know, because of the nature of the process. We were literally, you know, yesterday, not to blow anything for the Leverage finale, but we had a big chase sequence. And Dean Devlin said, you know, wouldn't this be cooler if this was a train? I said, well, I suppose, but where do you get one? Well, it turns out you can get one. And so we were in a car yesterday that had little rollers on the bottom that let you drive on the train track, driving the route for our giant train chase. And I was like, yeah, this doesn't happen in other jobs. This is pretty unique and cool, you know. And that's the thing is, TV, you write it, they shoot it, it's on in a couple of weeks. It's a great feeling of completion.
I mean, you're like Harold with the purple crayon or something, where you just draw a dragon on the wall and suddenly the dragon appears.
Yeah, and then our line producer, Paul Bernard, who has to balance the budget, shows up and makes the dragon into a gecko and then tells us what's in the budget. But I got to tell you, because of the nature of shooting in Portland and the cooperation we get from both Portland, both just people on the street and also the institutions here, we get a lot more for our show than we get anywhere else. So we can actually do some pretty big, cool stuff here.
I got to tell you, and it's, I think as long as you occasionally blow something up downtown, you could probably have people come and just shower you with rose petals and wave palm fronds at you.
Portlanders like when we blow stuff up. Other cities, there's fire ordinances, the cops show up. Portland shows up like as a party when we blow stuff up. It's pretty interesting.
One of the things, and that day that the car was blown up downtown, it's been maybe, I don't know, a year ago, something like that now, where there's, and I didn't even know, I forget what time of day it happened, but all I know is that I looked at my phone and I just started, the texts and just, you know, phone calls and emails were coming in, and I was like, well, what the hell is going on? And they would all just be, you know, things like fire down to explosion, and I was like, oh my God, what is it, the end times are at hand? And then I started getting these blurry sort of photographs where you would just see like an orange streak going by outside an office window or something. And that is when you guys had blown up this car. Is that a thing where you just write it in some way, because you're thinking, like, I just want to see this happen, so I'm going to put it in the script?
There's sometimes you do that. There's sometimes you write in, like, more character beats. There's more times with the actors. It's like, yeah, I want to see... we have a Christmas episode coming up, and that Will Wheaton's in that one, actually. That's why he was back in town. And to a great degree, it was so I could get Will Wheaton into the outfit we had in mind. You know, it's like, I'll spend $2 million of someone else's money to put Will Wheaton in this outfit. There's times, you're really focused on the plot, but there's times less that you write just to see it and more where it's you write it hoping you'll see it. You know, like, I don't know if we'll do this, but we'll see if we can pull it off. And then, you know, Lord help us.
I think you're,
you know, you're
the,
in a helicopter.
You're sort of the you're sort of the LeBron James of Portland television, where you just, well, I'm going to see if I can ask for X and just have them do it for me.
You never know. Yeah, and that's the thing, is you never know what's going to be cheap or expensive. I mean, we found out, looking at the cost, that it was just easier to blow stuff up in real life than do it digitally. So we went back to where, you know, like old 1960s models and explosions and stuff. In Portland, it's just easier.
You know, I wish that somebody would just write an open memo to every movie studio that said what you just said, which is that, just because the computer is sitting there. I was going to say a Cray supercomputer, but I'm dating myself because that's the last Starfighter thing. But, whatever it is that they make CGI on now, here's a perfect example. My wife had gone to, she had gone to Peru recently, and so she wanted to see Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And I tried to warn her. I was like, baby, we don't have to watch that. You don't feel like you have to be a completist. And so we watched it, and, you know, she felt that it was sort of let down. And then about 3 weeks later, we watched the movie Creepshow from 1983, which is the Romero Stephen King anthology.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Crystal Skull has that scene with all the CGI ants, and they're, you know, attacking the guy, and then they go down the hill. You watch Creepshow, and they've got E.G. Marshall on a set with like 150,000 obviously real cockroaches. And then I watched,
I remember that.
Yeah, and I watched this 2-hour documentary, and somebody said, well, how'd you get the cockroaches? And he's like, what do you mean? We got cockroaches. We went to Venezuela. We got cockroaches. We brought them back. Bada bing. Did they do the CGI, do you think, because of that it is cheaper, or a flawed belief that it's cheaper, or because it's just habit?
A lot of times it is cheaper. It's very specific stuff. Sometimes is less expensive. A lot of times it's fine control. A lot of times it's the director's vision. And I think just the system's kind of wired for it now. You know, the movie making is a big, giant industry that turns slowly. And so when it adopts something, it settles in on that because the workflow is built around that. It's time and money. It's anytime you can take something off the set and put it not on the set when you're burning daylight with actors, you try to do that. And sometimes you make mistakes and sometimes you don't. But a lot of it is also this kind of false belief of what CG can promise, can deliver, pardon me. It's really hard to make good looking CG, no matter how much money you're spending. There's good moments, but to maintain any CG sequence over a long period of time, the seams start to show because the brain and the eye is very smart.
Right.
You know? And so that's the tricky bit. Like, there's a lot of CG assistant movies that you've seen that you won't recognize because it's built around a real stunt. But it's when you get into the realm of pure CG that things start to look weird.
Let's see, we have a message here. This is a Skype message. Somebody says, we all know that Vin Diesel is a Dungeons... We were talking to Aaron about this yesterday. I said, we all know that Vin Diesel is a Dungeons & Dragons player. Are there other Hollywood celebrities who are not, quote, out as D&D fans?
Steve Colbert.
Oh,
Steve
well.
Steve Colbert is infamously...
And the odds makers take a beating.
Yeah, Robin Williams... giant D&D fan. It's more the creative side. It's much easier. It's just we're kind of the generation now of guys who run shows and develop shows, and women too, pardon me, I use guys collectively, that grew up from that geek culture that now that we've hit like late 30s, early 40s, we go, wait, we can play this, and it's the, why not play this instead of poker? You've got a fair number of D&D and role-playing games, not just D&D, but like Savage Worlds and other systems kicking around, amongst the writer class now, amongst the writers that that didn't exist definitely like 15, 20 years ago.
What's your preferred character class?
D&D, I don't know, I kind of like Ranger. The new Ranger's pretty cool. It's pretty flexible. The new Avenger class is pretty neat. I used to always play Rogues. Yeah, it's just I don't like spellcasting classes. Don't know why. Never really tried to do them.
Don, I wish you could. I really wish you could see the smile on Don's face right now. It really is. I think it's threatening some sort of mandibular injury. The extent to which she is beaming right now.
I'm married to a big gamer, so it's I'm more familiar with all of this than I would have been, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah,
far more familiar.
But there's a massive number of photos of you at Ren Fairs, so it's not like, it's not like there's a huge difference there or anything.
Hey, I just sit with a pizza and roll dice. I don't get into the corset. You know, there's definitely a difference here.
Awesome.
I don't think any of us are fighting from the high ground on this one.
What you've got all of this stuff going on, and you know, you're just you're obviously a guy who, I don't know if it's just that you get bored easily, or if you feel like Henry Rollins said this great thing one time. He said that when he was born, he felt like there was a timer strapped inside of his head that somebody hit the button on, and it was counting down till zero. And he's like, I got to do as much stuff as possible before the zero hits. And what is that your thing? Is that why you are Mr. Multitask all the time?
I try not to be. To tell you the truth, it's more I tend to find stuff that's cool. I mean, I know guys are just driven, just ambitious and driven and just relentless, and they have 9 million projects. It's more I tend to be doing one thing and something shiny catches my eye, and then I wander into it, and then I promise to do something, and then I wind up having to deliver. It's really just more bad habits than work ethic, I got to say. And that was my cell phone with the theme from Cowboy Bebop as the ring. I'd love to say that I'm some sort of master of all media like J.J. Abrams. Honestly, I'm a geek with a short attention span, and I get paid to write. So, you know, I kind of fell into this.
Awesome. We could not possibly go out on a better line than that. I know you're a busy guy. You got stuff to do. John Rogers, head writer, creator for Leverage, the master of myriad trades and pursuits. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. We would love to have you on again, sir.
Thanks, sir, and I'll swing by the studio sometime.
Thank you. There you go. John Rogers, ladies and gentlemen. Best of continued success in life, art, and all things. All right, there you go. Did I lie? How great is that guy?
He is awesome. I was just sharing this on Facebook. I just asked Leverage creator John Rogers what his favorite character class is when he plays D&D.
Did you hear him say that his cell phone ring is Cowboy Bebop?
I did.
Yeah.
See?
All right, there you go. I am
so in love with him right now.
Seriously, he's... I don't mean to keep going on and on about this, but I mean... Because
I just looked at a picture too. He's a big old good looking bear of a man.
You know what he looks like? He looks like Ricky Jay. If you know Ricky Jay,
oh, he's much better looking than Ricky Jay.
Well,
at least from the photos I just
well,
saw.
Okay. Then see, now I feel like I've just insulted him. Is it? But I mean, that's what he reminded me. Ricky Jay, who was one of the camera guys in Boogie Nights, and he was in Heart 8 and whatever. I hate to be like one of those guys. Like, well, when we were hanging around on the set talking about Will Wheaton, you know, and Kevin Mitnick, because I'm not people who knows people. I'm people who knows people who knows like other people who will be good enough to call the show. He is the coolest guy. And
yeah, he's one of those guys that I could see you would just want to spend just hours just talking to him.
On Outlook Portland, I always over-prepare. I mean, I come up with like 50 questions because, you know, occasionally you'll get guests that aren't bad, but sometimes you'll get a guest where you say like, so, blah, 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 blah. And they go, yeah, pretty much. You know, and then you're like, okay, crap. But we got like 3 questions done that whole show because he was just so fantastic an interview. I mean, he was exceptional in every way. And something I was going to say is some other point that is now lost to me. But anyway, that is why I was so thrilled to have him
so
on the show.
So hepped up.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's just... And that was my other thing, is that, you know, you and I have both interviewed the people who make movies or who work in television, or, you know, or who have, you know, are involved in show business, like, not in a radio way, like in a real, actual way, to some degree. And, I forgot to mention, it's probably just for the best. I forgot to mention the whole thing about my audition for Leverage. That just would have been awkward. I'm kind of glad I didn't.
I thought about mentioning it, and I thought, I'll bet Rick doesn't want to mention it because it would just seem kind of...
It would seem self-serving.
Self-serving.
And I actually forgot about it, so I guess it's my brain's way of telling me that we're not going to discuss it. But, you meet so many of those guys who... It's not that they're rude sometimes, but it's just that... You can tell that they've heard all the questions 1,000 times, and so whenever you ask them something... It's like the little tape player in their head just spools off the answer.
Yeah.
You know? So, Stephen King, where do you get your ideas? And you hear this like, chunk, and it just and, you know, and he probably has questions he answers a lot, but he is invested. I've seen other interviews with him, and he's always invested in the interview.
I've always found that my personal experience has been that directors and like people like John Rogers, who are sort of like screenwriters or guys behind the scenes making something, tend to be much more interesting and have a lot more to talk about if you actually choose some questions that are not the standard fare.
Right.
There's so if you show any like interest or any insight that you've actually done a little bit of intelligent research, they're usually, you know, I mean, I've interviewed people like Guillermo del Toro, who is like, once you start, I start talking to him, I start talking about old Italian horror movies, and he just perked right up, and suddenly right. we have like 2 hours, you know, about Mario Bava, you know, and it's, and so it's, but with actors do tend to get into that kind of rote yeah. answer thing, and they can be tough. But the guys like John Rogers, you know, if you show interest in what they actually do, because they don't give as many interviews
right.
as actors do.
Well, so. And they, and I mean, again, I mean, for a guy who's going on an audition later today, I'm not trying to knock actors, but I'm not saying actors don't create either, because they do in their own sort of interpretive way. And sometimes actors are also writers. But
usually when you're in a position of interviewing an actor for something, they are on a publicity
they're pushing a product
for something. And yeah. they have been answering the same questions over and over, and they're already kind of tired of talking about
right.
what they're talking about by the time you get to them. And it's really hard to come up with something that isn't something they've already heard before.
Well, and it's, you know, and it's the difference between interviewing. Never mind. You know, we're just wanking yeah. ourselves about like how great we are at interviewing and how you know, the cool people we can talk to. But so there's that guy. So he's pretty awesome. So here's the thing: we're a little bit of a timeline here, because I got a motor if I'm going to make that funeral. So we've got the top five, which I think we're going to. I know I'm being this guy. We're going to have no choice probably but to bump the top five, because it's okay. the Jim Steinman thing, and I want to have time, because I know you're a big fan of Jim Steinman, and you were all agog at the, you were all McRib is back and everything at the idea of the top five. So we're probably going to have to push that. And so forth. So we've got some other things to get to, but let's just go right back to the news desk here. And we're going to go right to that. All right. So let me prepare this. Ladies yeah. and gentlemen, without further ado, and by the way, this is actually a good time to note that if you just heard part of that interview, the Rick Emerson Show is now available on iTunes every day. You just go to rickemerson.com/iTunes to find out more. It's also the splash page right now available on iTunes, and will be archived later on this afternoon. You can also give a gift subscription if you like for just 32 cents a day.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
We have a Taser Watch.
Fantastic. Without further ado, here is your Taser Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You got me running, going out of my mind.
I didn't do it, bro!
You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time.
Don't taste me, bro!
Awesome. God warms the heart
yes.
and the skin.
A Florida deputy.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida. Used his taser on a man wielding a power saw who refused orders to put it down.
Awesome.
David Bonvisuto, 45, of Fort Myers, Florida.
Where? Sorry, I didn't even wait that time.
Was charged Saturday night with aggravated assault on a law enforcement officer and resisting a law enforcement officer with violence. According to the sheriff's officer report, A man called deputies and reported that Myers was breaking a portable tiki bar with a bat in the man's driveway.
Why? There's so many layers of WTF to this story that I don't even... Why would there be a portable tiki bar in your driveway? Why would you be assaulting it with a bat? Why would you have a power saw?
Well, when he saw the man attacking his tiki... When the man saw Myers attacking his tiki bar with a bat, instead of confronting the man, he thought it would be good to call deputies. The deputy arrived and saw Bonvisuto then dismantling the tiki bar with a portable handsaw.
Of course, like you do.
Bonvisuto was told numerous times to put the saw down, but when he walked toward the deputy with the saw still circulating, the deputy deployed his taser.
Awesome.
Bonvisuto dropped Excellent. The saw and fell, but then tried to get back up. So the deputy gave him a second burst
Never
with the taser.
Never try to get back up. When you're down, stay down.
He was arrested. He remained Monday in jail with a bond denied because he'd been arrested in May for battery.
Excellent. There you go. And that was taking place where, Dawn?
Florida.
There we go. Fantastic. All right. There's your, whatever, I'm sorry. Now, see, that was me being too clever. I tried to do like 9 different things at once there. My brain just locked up. All right. That was your taser watch. Now I've completely lost the watch thing. I've buried the watch window behind my, all right, there we go.
You got me running, going out of my mind.
I didn't do it.
Tried to out-clever myself there.
Don't taste me, bro.
I'll tell you once
Excellent. There you go. There's your Taser Watcher. This is Don Taylor.
So do you still have this song for the Barefoot Bandit?
I do, actually. If you want to give me just a second, okay. I will dig that up.
Well, so, I will share the story while you're looking for it.
All right. So this is the Barefoot Bandit is the kid that stole the plane. Well, he stole all of that stuff, right, over the course of however many years.
Stole planes and cars, and he broke into houses and stuff. He pleaded guilty in the Bahamas today and is expected to be deported to the United States to face prosecution on all of the things he did in the U.S. He pleaded guilty to illegal entry into the country at his first court appearance in the Bahamas, where he had flown a stolen plane. The charge stemmed from his crash of the plane on an island, which that carries a $300 fine or 3 months in jail, followed by deportation. He smiled after the judge read the sentence. Bahamian police said earlier that he would face other charges, including illegal weapons possession related to a string of break-ins, boat thefts, and thefts during his week-long hideout in the country.
But he's become a little bit of a folk hero. I know that before they caught him, this is over the last couple of years, they would, you know, the so-called Barefoot Bandit has struck again, and we would make the obligatory observation that crime is wrong, but that he was sort of righteous in a sort of don't do this kids kind of way. So the people sort of cottoned to him, as my grandmother would say.
Yes. And we did find a lovely song that someone, a band called Negative Zero.
Well, let's be fair about this. You found this.
Yes.
I'm merely the guy hitting the button over here. So this is Negative Zero, and I believe this is called... I think it's just called The Ballad of the Barefoot Bandit.
Yes.
I have only heard about 4 seconds of this, and that was enough to order you not to play anymore because I felt we should save it for the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Negative Zero and the ballad of the Barefoot Bandit. Theoretically speaking, that's just it's not actuality that I have there. That's, there we go. I sense this is one man. Sort of like a five for fighting of the Barefoot Bandit world.
Shenanigans never seem so serious.
What language is this?
Sounds like it's slow.
I'm just playing it right off of a...
Shenanigans never seem so serious.
No, this sounds like the thing you were playing for me.
You have to run away to fill your heart. A bar we know as mysterious is taking what he wants, never what he needs.
I'm so confused. Pause this for a second. What's going on in this song? What the hell?
I mean,
don't look at me like I'm playing it wrong. This is how the song sounds. Okay?
Okay.
There was a little bit of lag with playing the song, but every other piece of sound today has played sounding the way that it's supposed to. This is how this song was recorded. I mean, does he have a speech impediment? Has he just taken a Coldplay song and then removed the vocals like with a karaoke function on his laptop or something and then just sort of wail over the top? Let's just... I'm catching about every ninth word.
I think he said, he can fly, and so can I. Is that what he said?
All I heard, I literally thought he said, I can fly something, 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 but apparently not. Touch the sky. I got that. I got a whole sentence there.
Then he crashes?
Crashes.
Crashes.
He'll never die.
Are you reading the lyrics? Be honest.
No, I'm listening. I can't find the lyrics.
We're not even halfway through this song, by the way. We are 40% of the way into this composition.
Wow.
I want this played at my funeral. With no explanation given. But then in order that everyone is to remain solemn and silent.
He can
Okay, we're done. That's the end of that. We're not listening to that anymore. That's, you know how bad that song is? It's bad enough that my soundboard refused to play it. Yeah. I had to open it in like Winamp or something. Jesus God, there's no that doesn't need to exist, Don. In no conceivable reality. Well, you know what that sounds like. Have you ever heard the Goodbye Anna Nicole song?
Oh yeah.
Goodbye Nicole. It's like one guy that records all of those. There must be. And the Goodbye Anna Nicole song in turn sounds like the Remembering Lacey song, which the guy recorded about Lacey Peterson. You've heard that.
Yeah.
It's about Lacey Peterson and Connor, whatever. They all have that same, like, he's got a retainer in. But the only thing it does is keeps his lips from forming vowel sounds correctly, and so they're all cut like this.
Well, who is it that these guys are mimicking? Because there does seem to be they're trying to do some kind of rock and roll singer sound.
They do have a distinct style. You're right. They all kind of hue within the same tonal lines.
Yeah.
I'm just unclear. It is possible that we're overthinking the whole thing. Yes. I don't want to harsh your mellow or anything. It's conceivable that they're just talentless, Don. I don't want to break your heart. All right. Let's see. Well, let's do a couple more here.
So much news here. I don't even know.
Well, what did we promise? We promised a snuff watch. We should do that because
okay,
that's going to be dated
watch.
As of tomorrow.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. Now it's actually closing that program that's taking forever. It hates everything about this song. All right. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
How about a snuff watch?
Here's your snuff watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. It was still trying to play the crashing song. I'm going to expunge that from my computer entirely with extreme prejudice later on. I'm not going to have it gumming up the works anymore. All right, here's your snuff watch for Tuesday.
George Steinbrenner, 80, has died from a heart attack. The New York Yankees and their fans are mourning the death of the man known as the Boss. George Steinbrenner died after suffering a heart attack. Former Yankee Bucky Dent said that Steinbrenner helped revive the team in the 1970s.
Over the Yankees, you know, they were just kind of like floundering. You know, it was the Yankees, but it wasn't the Yankees. And then he started to build that momentum.
And that's who? Bucky Dent?
That was Bucky Dent.
Here's the great thing about George Steinbrenner is that, I mean, everybody talks about what a bastard he was, but as big a dick as he clearly could be from time to time, you got to like the fact that he outlived nearly all of his detractors. I mean, he lived to see almost all the people who hated him in the ground. So that's got to be. He probably lived just long enough for that. You know, once he outlived Billy Martin, he figured, you know, why stop now? And because he was just so bent on winning. He signed, there's a fantastic book called The Bronx is Burning by Jonathan Mahler. And it tracks basically a single year in the life of New York City. And it has two interwoven stories. One is the quest for the mayoral position, which ultimately went to Ed Koch. And Ed Koch was running against, it wasn't Mario Cuomo, it was, I forget who it was. Well, Giuliani was in the mix at that point. But anyways, Ed Koch, so it's the mayoral race. And then the other side of that equation is it tracks the Yankees' run for the pennant. And that was when George Steinbrenner was the owner, Billy Martin was the manager, and they had just hired Reggie Jackson for $3 million, which was sort of groundbreaking in 1977 and ushered in the era of big money sports. And they all hated each other. That was the great thing, is it Steinbrenner and Billy Martin and Reggie Jackson just loathed one another, but they all knew that their fates were sort of inextricably lashed together, that if they, you know, if they wanted to be successful, they had to sort of stick it out. And anyway, so it tracks the Yankees and Steinbrenner and Billy Martin and Reggie Jackson and the mayoral race all through 1977. And then the book sort of climaxes during this four-day blackout, this four-day power outage that happened during the hottest week of the summer while Sound of Sam was killing people. And it was just like the most if there was ever a moment, and I'm not some like a New York historian. I mean, I am fortunate to know people who lived through that time, and then this book is really exhaustively detailed in this way. If there was ever a moment where New York was just going to like just do itself in and just implode, I mean, that would have been it. But these guys were all at the center of it. And, I mean, Steinbrenner, he fired Billy Martin. Well, I guess he fired him five times and hired him back four times. I mean, Billy Martin worked for the Yankees five times because every time he'd go to work there, Steinbrenner would just have it with him and just boot him out. He was just a bastard, but great.
Well, and in a 1998 interview with CNN, Steinbrenner admitted he was a tough boss.
Not an easy guy to work for because I'm a tough boss. But I don't expect anything more of my players and my people than I'm willing to pay myself.
And apparently he was so opposed. I think a Nibbler was talking about this earlier, that he made illegal campaign contributions to Richard Nixon. And I think also he got busted at one point for using a private detective to dig up dirt on his own players because he didn't want to have to give them raises because he just hated paying Reggie Jackson that $3 million, but he just saw there was no way around it. So one of a kind. I don't think you could really be like that guy anymore. I think the time when you were sort of openly allowed to behave as George Steinbrenner did, I think those times are drawing to a close, for better or worse. All right.
We also have, I believe, if you want to play it.
Is it more from Bucky?
Yes, Bucky Dent recalling his fondest memory of George Steinbrenner.
On the phone and said, you know, I have a trade to make you a Yankee. I mean, that's going to be the phone call that I'm always going to remember, you know, because it was the moment that my dream came true.
I wish I knew more about Bucky Dent so I could make some sort of pithy observation.
Bucky Dent's fondest memory really doesn't seem to have as much to do with Steinbrenner as it does with Bucky Dent.
Well, Bucky Dent deserves his moment in the sun as well, Don Taylor. Who is George Steinbrenner, even in death, to hog the glory? All right, George Steinbrenner, dead, dead, dead. There you go. There's your snuff watch. You should do something that doesn't require sound.
Okay.
Right here.
I was planning to.
All right, because we're going to all pretend right now that I'm not getting up from the mic for a second and opening the studio door and then coming right back.
Okay.
You just act as though I'm here.
I don't know.
Make some glib observation and then go, come on, or whatever.
We have an update on the 87-year-old woman who was shocked by a taser by a Clackamas sheriff's deputy. It turns out she was waving around a pellet gun and not an actual firearm. As we reported here previously, Clackamas County deputies were called to a mobile home park in Boring, Oregon, after a report that a woman was waving a gun and threatening a man who was excavating a trench. The deputies said they told Phyllis Owens to drop the gun. She initially obeyed the order, put the gun down, but then picked it back up again, and a sheriff's deputy fired a taser at her. She fell unconscious. CPR was performed at the scene, but she died an hour later at the hospital.
I mean, come on.
And it turns out that what she had was a black pellet pistol and not a firearm.
You know, that shouldn't even be news. There's not even any reason to. The only reason to report that is because you want to try to make the cop look bad for shooting her.
And yet we both printed this out and put it in the news pile separately.
No, because I wanted to make the observation that story is, in other words, To me, the story isn't that she had a pellet gun. The story is that it's apparently news that she had a pellet gun when it doesn't matter. I mean,
yeah.
You point something that looks like a gun at a cop, and he's gonna give you what for.
Yeah.
And in this case, she dead?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, don't point things that look like cops, guns at cops, and that won't happen. I'm not saying right or wrong. Self-preservation should dictate that if you have a thing that looks like a gun, keep that put away. Just don't point it.
Especially
over there.
If you're 87 years old and, you know, might not survive a taser.
That's the thing. I mean, really, yes, it'd be, you know, to judge your own ability of surviving 50,000 volts applied to your skin, you know, and just to move forward accordingly. Hey, we got to wrap this up here in a second, and I know that I'm going to get a bunch of, I only got my 27 cents worth today. It's going to have to be okay with everybody that, we'll go longer tomorrow. But I have to go to my leverage audition now, you know, because, look, here's the thing. And how great would it be if I actually get the role somehow? Statistically unlikely. But then I would have, we'd have another reason to get John Rogers back.
I see an envelope full of headshots.
Do you want to see my headshot here?
I do.
All right. So this is, all right, there you go. Look at how professional I look in that.
That's the same picture I've seen like 100 times. It's just really big.
Yeah,
it's just 8x10 glossy.
Well, therefore, it's better, though, because there's more of me. See?
Interesting you went with the full bleed on the photo rather than having the white border and the...
What is the full bleed?
That means it goes all the way to the edge.
Sounds like a Cannibal Corpse record.
It's a printing term. It goes all the way out to the edge without any kind of white border.
Yes, with my vast experience as a professional printer.
Well, most headshots have a white border, and then there's white on the bottom, and it has your name and contact information for your agent.
Well, that's for other people. That's okay. I say sabotage. Don't correct me.
All right.
It sickens me. Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, what are you going to do? It's got my name in the back, you know. They'll either call me or not call me.
Well.
Border Schmorter.
We just talked D&D with the creator of the show. How could they not hire you to play morgue attendant?
It seems like they would do that the same way they didn't hire me to play any of the last roles that I auditioned for, like, the previous five times. They'd ignore me. That's what it is. They just don't call, Don. All right. And on that note, and you know what I did is I just closed the thing that I need to end the show with. I was putting the cart before the horse and the other thing before the thing that goes after it. Don't forget, coming up tomorrow on the program, Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be here. Also, the one and only, I can't even get a chance to to promote this much, coming up tomorrow, Mr. Dr. Demento as well. We will have an interview with the one and only.
Mr. Dr. Demento?
Mr. Doctor. Well, let me ask you. Well, never mind. I don't have time. I don't have time. I got to go. I got to go audition for the thing. So tomorrow we will have an exceptionally fantastic and extra long show to make up for the fact that you're getting short shrift today. But tomorrow, Dr. Demento and Aaron Mesh. So forth. We want to thank our very special guest, John Rogers, for joining us today. So thank you for joining us, Mr. Rogers, wherever you may be. Don't forget the Rick Emerson Show continues next and 24 hours a day right here on the live stream at rickemerson.com. And we're also on iTunes now. Rick Emerson Show coming to you from the studios of the Rick Emerson News Network. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor. Advanced Technology and Magic by Thomas Gale. Executive producer Bruce Agler. And our chief of staff is Cheryl Kenakoa. Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Tuesday, July 13th, 2010. And that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Watch out for snakes. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.